Hello and welcome to RCGP Together Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP Membership Communities team. I'm Evie, and it's Mental Health Awareness Week, which falls this year in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. So this week, we're sharing perspectives on mental health.
So hi everybody, I'm Alka, I am a GP, and I'm also a lifestyle medicine doctor, so I'm a lifestyle medicine physician, and that's kind of really my, I guess my arena, my passion, the stuff that really drives me is really that focus on self-care and self-compassion, which I guess is so central when we start sort of talking about mental health and mental illness and mental health awareness. They're all words that kind of get bandied about. So I hope kind of through the conversation today, we'll kind of just unravel maybe a bit of definition for all of us. And as you say, kind of perspective on even what those words mean. So yeah, that's a really brief hello from me. I work as a GP. I've also got sort of my own private practice in lifestyle medicine as well. So hi, everybody.
I'm Emma, and I'm a sessional stroke portfolio GP from Northern Ireland. And I have a very keen interest in wellbeing. I have done for the past few years. And really, in terms of my passion for wellbeing, it's making sure that I can survive in the job for the next 30 years after, you know, finishing GP a few years ago. I'm a advocate of physical health, and in particular arts as well, in terms of managing wellbeing. I take part in triathlons and use that to manage my own personal mental health. And so I really try and encourage people to really take up physical pursuits or the artistic pursuits to try and manage their wellbeing.
All I can say is wow to the triathlon. So I'm Liz England. I'm a GP in Birmingham. I've always worked in Birmingham. I suppose my interest in this area is more of the actual mental health side of things. So I was the RCGP mental health lead for a while, well, it was the priority. And I've been an academic GP looking at mental illness in children and young people. So early intervention for first episode psychosis. So really, I'm kind of sort of the things I'm seeing are more from a patient perspective, but I've been involved in sort of trying to look at how you can improve the mental health of GPs as well through things like the practitioner health program and so forth.
Hi, I'm Alex Lai. I'm a first five GP in South London and first five rep. And I'm on the RCGP Wellbeing Committee.
I don't know that one.
Is that Siri?
Amazon, good old Amazon. My interests in mental health and well-being really became a priority when in my first year of GP training, my partner had his first episode of psychosis. So from there, I sort of developed a real interest in resilience and how to cope with caring, and then went on to support other people and became an ambassador in health and well-being for my local trust, supporting other staff members who had been dealing with difficult issues or burnout, and really just focus on supporting trainees and now first five doctors to get through the difficulties they're facing.
So, Alex, you kind of touched on this briefly, but it will be interesting to hear how each of you sort of ended up where you are, if you like. So ended up in the sort of academic or the clinical remit, Liz, or Alka ended up in the lifestyle area. It'd be interesting to kind of hear those pathways and see where those have led you.
Mine was, it's quite easy. Helen Lester, who sadly passed away a number of years ago, but she was a fantastic GP and a really active member of the college, passionate about mental health. And so I did an academic registrar role where you did half-time general practice and half-time academia. And really, it sort of snowballed from there because at that point in time, mental health wasn't very sexy. Nobody really wanted to do it. So every time something mental health came up, I got asked to get involved. And really, I just continued to work with the college and develop things and stuck my nose in as many places as possible, really, to promote mental health and well-being and things like the resilience and how we pick things up earlier. What is the role of GPs in all of this? So at that point in time, GPs weren't that interested in mental health, I have to say. I mean, we're talking a good 10, 15 years ago. And I think one of the fantastic things is over time, I've really seen colleagues become more passionate, more interested, appreciate their own mental health and patients. You know, it's so critical to everything we do.
Yeah, so I kind of probably I've had a really interesting year. I mean, I've been a GP for 20 years, probably more than all of you here, maybe. And I guess for me, general practice almost felt like breathing, you know, just natural and effortless. Even though it's hard work, it just felt like something I could just do. And it was this time last year that there wasn't an event or anything like that. It was just a moment, I think, when I started recognizing that revolving door of general practice, that kind of sense that all this great advice that I thought I was giving, it just wasn't touching people enough. And particularly as I think you've been highlighting, Liz, is, you know, in that kind of emotional sphere, in that mental health sphere, even kind of chronic disease, it wasn't what I wanted to be as a doctor when I was in med school, wasn't kind of what I was doing. And so I just made a big, bold move, and I didn't expect to do this, but I left the comfort of my partnership, and it's a kind and caring partnership. And I just remember one day I was texted my husband saying, I'm going to go and do some solo travel. What do you think? And he texted back. He was away at the time saying, do what you need to do. And what I did was I booked a flight the day after I left my partnership, and I went off to India. And I traveled alone, which I'd never done before. And I went to Kerala and I went to do some voluntary work. And I'd never done any of this before. I didn't speak any of the language. And I just went out there. And I think what happened there was kind of that bubble burst. And what I saw was a lot of kindness. And I saw a lot of compassion. And I saw communities, you know, despite the poverty, people were looking after people. Doctors were looking after doctors. People were looking after people. There was a real sense as I came back, and I just kind of found what I need, and I found lifestyle medicine, which took me back all the way to what health really is about, whether it's emotional or physical or mental. It's that kind of awareness. And so I went crazy in terms of kind of research and reading and insights, and got a diploma in lifestyle medicine, able to become a lifestyle medic. Coaching is something that I've been really, really, really close to. It's a conversation style I've always had. I just never knew what to call it. So went off and got a coaching qualification. And exactly what you've said, Liz, there's so much emotional health that comes our way. I felt as a doctor I needed to be more able and able to have these conversations. So I just trained in ACT therapy, which is a sort of form of CBT. And suddenly you can be that doctor you want to be, and you can impart the stuff that makes a difference to that revolving door. And I think that's kind of where, you know, where I've come at it. It's been a year of real grounding, I think, and understanding of how we can really make a difference to people's lives. And I think the mental health space really demands that from us, but we've got to do it a different way. Absolutely. Definitely. You know, completely. These long waits for CBT. I had a patient this morning, I'm a GP with practitioner health as well, and she'd been to her GP 8 months, she was told. 8 months for a therapy that would transform her. Yeah. But what was going to happen to her in that time? Yeah. We know, you know, it's so hard. So I think, you know, mental health awareness, I think it's, for me, it's less about the awareness and more about the action.
I think from my point of view, I got very interested in particular in GP wellbeing a few years ago after going through the training and finding that there was a lot of negativity around GPs, and a lot of pressure was put on GPs to keep producing more and more, staying later, working harder, being everything to everybody, and looking at some of the mental health issues that some of my colleagues were suffering from really in silence, and then hearing stories about GPs who maybe went on to commit suicide as a result of the pressures on the job. I remember looking at it at that time and thinking to myself, is this a career that I would like to get involved in the future? Is this, you know, is this sustainable for the future? And at that time, I made a decision that I was going to have to look into this a bit further. I was going to have to look and see, you know, well, what was the college doing to try and help and improve well-being for GPs like myself and for my colleagues, so that I could stay in the workforce for the next 20, 30 years. And of course, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, find the job very easy and get on really well with the job, but there is a vast majority who are really struggling with lots of stress and things out there as well. And so that's what triggered me to become involved in the GP Wellbeing Working Group in the first place, so that I could become a part of the dialogue to help improve change. And it has been really, really helpful to hear other people's stories about what has been going on in their life. And also has been really reassuring that the college has been doing a lot of things to try and improve well-being and campaigning for GPs within the workplace. And in particular at this time, you know, through all of this COVID-19, you know, to know that the college is doing things behind the scene to try and help ease the pressure for GPs. For example, at the minute, I've been doing a lot of reviews of different resources to help improve GP's well-being for the COVID-19 hub and the well-being resource. And even through looking at all those resources that have come through, including Alka's and Alex's resource that has been put through, it's been fantastic. All the things that people have been doing out there to champion mental health and champion well-being, and it's really nice to be able to contribute to that in, you know, even a small way. As I said before, I try to maintain my own personal well-being through, you know, exercising, which has been quite challenging through this time with the coronavirus. But for me, I couldn't manage my well-being without exercise. It's really crucial.
Do you think, though, Emma, do you think it's enough? Like, it's a kind of genuine question. It feels like there is just so much resource and stuff out there for us at the moment. And we're probably a bit of a self-selected, you know, quadrangle here today, because I kind of, yay, you know, but actually, you know, my experience with Practitioner for Health, for example, is it's so sad. There's still lack of kindness in trust. There's still people who don't go that extra mile. There's still bullying. There's still harassment. There's still racial discrimination. There's still gender discrimination. It's still happening. Mm. So although we may be trying to do things and kick out resources and join the Zoom and go to this expert class and do all of this, is that the stuff that's really going to shift the culture and the mindset and stop people still feeling afraid of going to work? Because that literally is what the statistics are showing, isn't it? The stats are showing. I think Alex was talking about GPs in training. You know, trainees, I think 50% of trainees are feeling stressed at work. Mm. And it's meant to be a place where we have that joy, because we're giving out so much. We should be in a place to kind of receive it. But if, like, from the beginning of your career, you don't get that, as Alex was saying, as trainees, then what happens when you get to 20 years on, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely agree. I mean, I entered GP training off the back of the 2015 junior doctors strikes, when, you know, so many of the workforce were leaving for Australia and everyone was feeling so demoralized and negative about their careers. And I was there trying to champion, you know, how fortunate we were and try and flip that conversation. It's a stigma in itself in how we perceive our workplace, because, you know, it was a real fight to get people to appreciate the positives in our career and see the purpose and value in what we do, because it was so ingrained by then amongst all my colleagues and peers that, you know, oh, woe us for what's going on. And then it's about trying to make sure that whatever is going is improved on. So whether it was the hours and the contract or just the conversations we were having at work and making sure that we were providing support to each other. Because as you say, there is so much bullying and harassment that we need to overturn. And then there's the internal bullying that we place on ourselves because we've worked so hard to get where we are. And it's really hard to get rid of that critic in your brain. So going forwards, I think you're right. We do need to do more in terms of making sure that we recognize what we're doing. And it's great at the moment during COVID to see that there's some appreciation and hopefully people have found some new purpose and passion. But it's about changing the conversation perhaps and our image of ourselves and appreciating it ourselves.
I still think as well that nothing will really change until we feel confident enough to talk about our own personal mental health amongst each other. So I still find it difficult to say that I've had mental health problems. I still find it hard because people I know will automatically look at me and think, oh God, here we go, that kind of thing. If I got a kidney problem or a liver problem or, I don't know, a broken leg, you know, people ring you up, people are sympathetic. But if it's time off for whatever, you know, it still is very stigmatizing. And when I was doing some training, one of the students had had mental health problems previously, and it was all talked about in a very hushed way, you know. So, you know, I was told about it, but in a way, so we didn't want to upset her, but you know, you have to know as her trainer and things like that. And I just don't think that helps.
Absolutely. I fought the same stigma because once my partner became unwell, I had a period of feeling unwell. You know, it was, what do they call it? Not a grief reaction, but an adjustment.
Yeah.
And I just developed this anxiety about going back to work, even though it was only a couple of weeks, just because I was like, oh God, I'm starting back. And what are they all going to say? What are they going to think? You know, how are they going to treat me? I'm not going to know anything. And we suffer with imposter syndrome. And then being less than full time, people questioning, oh, why are you working less? You know, oh, we're having to make special adjustments for your rota. And so actually going forwards, just being a champion of less than full time, I really came to appreciate, you know, all the different variations of people's lives that we all need to understand and empathize with, because, you know, one in four people will develop mental health problems at some point, and that's so many of us.
I think the difficulty is around our vulnerability, and we're not comfortable yet with exposing our own vulnerabilities. And it's not only comfort, I think it's space. You know, in your busy day, in your general practice, you're there from your 9 to 6. Are you even taking 15 minutes out for a conversation with somebody, or are you on that prescription and then that visit? And then, you know, and I know when in my surgery, I had to booked appointments with myself at 12 o'clock. I booked an appointment with myself and I wrote under it going for a walk. So I could legitimize leaving the practice at 12:15 and I was going to go for a walk, because you need that. And I think we should maybe think about more of that, is legitimizing time to talk. Because do we do that? I think, and Alex, you've alluded to this quite a few times, that if you don't know the person in the room next to you, how are you going to know when their day is different or worse than normal? And I don't think, you know, we can be lonely in a busy world, can't we? We can be amongst our colleagues and patients and lots of people in our practice, but actually there's still that alonement because you're not sharing, you haven't got time to share your vulnerability, you've got space, no one's carved out time for you. But I do feel quite strongly that our time is our own. Our time does belong to us. We do get a say on what that, you know, 8 to 6 looks like, but we feel we don't. We feel that it's, you know, the 10-minute patient, but we don't. So how do we change that as a group? Because we should, you know, even as, I mean, it starts as an individual, doesn't it? You have to feel the strength to share your vulnerability, to map your day out the way you want to map it out. And there is all that kind of mirror neuroing going on. You know, people should be able to kind of emulate that because it's positive.
Partners can do that, though. I think there's still a real divide between partners and salaried GPs. So as a GP partner, you can block your appointments out, you can do all of that. As a salaried GP, I didn't have that option. I was there to see patients, to sign prescriptions, to do home visits. You know, if I'd have suggested blocking time out, I would have been, you know, why on earth would you block time out? We're busy. And I think maybe locums sometimes have a bit more control because they don't necessarily have stuff outside of the appointments. But I think salaried GPs and trainee GPs get it really rough. And I don't know how you rebalance that.
I will say from a trainee GP point of view, certainly once you do have a community that do support you and you can get peer advice and you change the norm and you offer examples of how other places are doing it and open that conversation, I think you can be surprised by how accommodating a supervisor can be.
Good.
And also, I think, you know, you've got to go back to a bit of the science. Like, we know that we're more productive if we have time out. If you want to come back and you want your salary doctor to get through those scripts, well, actually, there's even more value in getting out of the surgery. There's even more value in having a bit of time with your colleagues because you're even more supercharged and productive and effective and creative. And that's the science. So, you know, we're all very logical, us medics, aren't we? But just go back to the science, I guess. And I guess the other thing we know is that doctors who burn out are, I think the stats say, 30% more likely to make a medical error in the following 3 months. Now, that's quite a powerful statistic, I think. And again, I think we've got a professional obligation to look after each other, to not make those mistakes. You know, you're burnt out as it is, stressed it is, and on top of that, you're then going to get a complaint and a GMC warning because you're so exhausted from it all that you're destined to make an error, which actually, if you had that time out, that support, that change in the working day, you wouldn't be there at all. I think we do need to look at the numbers, we do need to look at the evidence, we do need to look at the science and all the physiology of how we work.
And I think RCGP has a role there in spreading the stories of how other practices are working differently, because, you know, I've just signed up to a new salaried role and I wouldn't, had they not placed workplace wellbeing as a priority.
I think the science argument, I really like that. And I think if you can mobilise a group of you so that you're not sort of fighting on your own, but if you can get a group of you together to say, look, this is the science, we want to work productively, we don't want to make mistakes, this is a really good way to do it. And give examples like you've just said. I think that's a very powerful argument to sway people. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Even Emma, the stuff you're doing, the stuff you love around movement, you know, if you bring 15 minutes of movement into your practice and do things together, there's again enough of an evidence base that says how powerful that is. That connectivity and that belonging, you know, the GMC document that talks about the ABC, doesn't it, of what we need. And, you know, belonging is really important. And so bringing movement into doing that, things that you can do together, I think it is that create a wellbeing practice. I think that's really key. It'd be great if we could, you know, as a college, that's what we champion. Are you a wellbeing practice, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, through all of this, you know, the COVID-19, the one thing I have found in Northern Ireland and as a locum is that GPs are actually really pulling together. And we maybe haven't been hit as bad as the mainland in terms of cases of coronavirus. And because of that, the workload hasn't been as strenuous on GPs. And what it has is changed a lot of practices in terms of more triage and any consultations. Patients have been a lot more grateful. I have never had as many people in my life send to me, oh, thank you so much, doctor, one, for your time and talking to me, and for all the work that you're doing, and that makes you feel really good. And the other thing that really good that has kind of been happening out of all of this and kind of changes in services is that GPs are actually looking after each other. They're asking each other how they are. We're mixing with more GPs as well, because you know, in Northern Ireland, if you worked in a partnership or a salary GP, you had to work in the COVID centre, and as a locum, you know, you might be offered some of the shifts. But because of that, we had then three groups of different kind of doctors, the salary, the GP partner, and the locum doctors all coming together. And the one thing I've realised is that GPs are lovely people. They're really lovely people. They're really passionate about their job.
Absolutely.
They're really hardworking. And actually, this time for GPs to sit back, to reflect on their work, to relook at services, to see where GP can now go in the future, because they've realised they actually were running at 10,000 miles an hour and they can't do that forever. And actually, I'm hoping that what GPs will now do is actually take all those changes and think, right, well, how can I now take this forward, maintain my own personal well-being, provide actually good patient care, because before it maybe wasn't as good as what it should be. Not everybody needs seen because of their, you know, their sore fingernail. Maybe that can be managed over the phone.
The good news is I was in a Zoom meeting last week, and that is what's happening with both the LMC looking at restart programs and recovery, and the future of general practice meeting, where we were discussing what are the positives we can take from this, you know, what new innovations, you know, you talk about the focus on workplace wellbeing, you know, various practices have introduced a huddle finally, or a coffee meeting, and an actual discussion, and about how to handle patient care and improve patient safety and look after each other. They're having Friday lunches together and actually getting outside. So it's fantastic. And I hold optimism in hoping that this continues and moves forwards in a positive way.
I think it's also, I was just thinking about the fact that we've had so much technological change as well. Mm-hmm. So one of our issues has been, if we have a practice meeting, because we have different doctors on different days, it's a small practice, none of us are really always in the same place at the same time together. So practice meetings have always been sort of one person, two people. But actually, with all this Zoom stuff, we've all been getting together. And okay, maybe it's not quite the same as being in the same room, but it's certainly better than it was before. At least I can see everybody that I work with at the same time, which I think is really good. And one of our local trusts has got this motto, no going back, which I really think we should champion now that miraculously suddenly we've managed to embrace video consultations and all of this sort of thing, you know, without it being terribly nothing major seems to have happened negatively so far. Yeah, so,
and it just shows how adaptive and fantastic we are, you know, be able to switch like that. You know, that isn't the case with hospital services. We are able to overnight make a decision and change how the hot hub runs or how our practice is going to run. And we can now accommodate more, a wider variety of GPs in what they want to do, or if they're vulnerable, or if they need to remote work.
I think we've still got a lot to do, haven't we, though? You know, it's a great start. It's like those teachable moments. You think that when you've had the heart attack is the time you're going to stop smoking. And a few do in those beginning few weeks, but how many people revert back to type? And I love the optimism, and I think it's great. And hopefully this is kind of, you know, that launch pad that we've kind of all needed, and the speed with which we're doing it. But, you know, I think I'm just thinking about even some of the COVID statistics. When you look at the risk factors for poorer outcomes, it's the people with obesity, hypertension and diabetes. And, you know, all of those, what have they got in common? Well, stress is a major contributor. And here we are as GPs, you know, at the peak of stress all the time. So we know our outcomes are not going to be to be great, whatever we're facing, you know, whether it's our risk of developing chronic illnesses ourselves. We sit all day long, and if there's something that's going to change from COVID, hopefully we're all standing and walking. I know at home I've now got myself a stand-up desk, so I stand up and it's great, and I've got little weights by my desk, and I've got, you know, I can move when I consult, and this is the stuff we need to embrace, because we know being sedentary all day long, what happens? Your longevity is shortened, your risk of death is about 7 to 10% higher than it should be. And I think it's all these little things that we probably need to keep layering and layering and layering. I don't think there's an end point. It's not, yay, we can do video consultations, or yay, it's Foodie Friday. I think it's that continuous layer. And it starts with the stuff we're talking about at the beginning, doesn't it? Which is space to talk and share and have some time together, for sure.
And time to process, you know, where you were saying that people aren't able to share. Unfortunately, I have had a friend who is a colleague, and they look after the care home, and they have not been sharing how they feel or processing the deaths, sadly, and it's caused a lot of mental health issues.
It is worrying, even, you know, this next phase, you know, post-COVID, what is going to happen? So, you know, everyone has been changing practices constantly, changing how you work. For example, myself as a locum, I had a lot of work cancelled during the period of, you know, all this coronavirus coming through. And, you know, what's going to happen now next, in the next few weeks, the few months, when the services start to ramp up again? You know, are people just going to go automatically expect things to go back to normal, which, you know, they can't? That normal has gone. Now there's going to be a new normal. Talking for myself as a locum, and with no kids, you know, you worry about your future. And I know, like a lot of my colleagues, you know, who maybe have kids or maybe have other responsibilities, they're worried, will they do they go back to normal? This coronavirus isn't going to go away, like, you know, just like that tomorrow. And, you know, where is all the work that has stalled over the past few weeks? Where's all that gone? Where's all the usual kind of workload gone? Are we going to be having a tsunami very shortly? I don't know.
I think, as I was saying right at the beginning, suddenly we were quite quiet for the first few weeks. But since they've started to talk about lift, it was even before they actually did lift the lockdown. It was when people were talking about possible lifting of the lockdown. Patients seemed to suddenly think that everything was okay and that the risk had gone. I think we're going to be very busy.
I think the tsunami is probably going to be doctors' health. I think that's what we're going to be seeing, the tsunami in, that big surge in real mental health concerns, those emotions that we're holding on to because we're so busy trying to do and give and be and deal with all the chaos and hold and fix people that actually, you know, we're talking about having space to talk, but actually we probably aren't letting ourselves have that emotional eruption now, and we're containing it and containing it and containing it. I think the well-being piece, the wellness piece, has to start now, and recognizing those telltale signs, because they're there, aren't they? They're, you know, I mean, I certainly have had sort of burnout myself before a number of years ago. When I look back, those telltale signs that I wanted to ignore were there, and I just didn't want to see them, you know, that clock watching, that sort of staying away from people, that kind of depersonalization. It's there, but we're not wanting to expose it now. But I think we definitely need to, A, make people aware of what those little TikToks are, those little signals are, so that people can tune in, but also give people tools. Like, what is the thing when we talk about wellness and well-being, but what is the thing that's going to, you know, make that difference, really? And it is layering, as I said, there's lots of things, but I think we need to start giving people the information about what works, backed up with the credibility piece and the evidence piece about what stuff can really, really make a difference to your day and your outcomes, I think. Because our trajectory is probably not great, is it?
No, mental totally health agree. Pandemic predicted for key workers and healthcare workers. And not just what you mentioned, but also permission to take time. So, You know, everyone has been running in this sort of fight or flight dealing. We cope well with the emergencies, but we're starting to see the fatigue, the exhaustion. It's the acute anxiety is turning into chronic anxiety, and people need to remember that actually they are allowed to take their annual leave during this period, because it's the whole oxygen mask analogy of looking after yourself. Otherwise you can't look after others.
And I think I've probably spent about 3 hours today talking to really vulnerable patients who are isolated, lonely, you know, that their whole lives really have collapsed around COVID-19 because they've got no social networks and things like that. And you have to be really careful that you don't then start to take some of that on, because that's when the early bits of the well-being start to drift. You know, you come home and you're thinking, oh God, I hope that person's okay. Mm-hmm. And GPs have always been really good at containing things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we hold patients, don't we, a lot of the time, that patient that has a crisis that keeps going to A&E, and because they can't get a community mental health team to see them, we hold them. And I've been doing a lot of that. And so I think that there is that thing about you've got to then make sure that you're able to process that, you're able to do something that your brain switches off completely from work. Maybe it's the triathlon. Not for me. I could run up the garden and that would probably be enough. But, you know, something that takes you away from it completely so that you can just...
But Liz, we're kind of one of the only, but we are a specialty. I call us generalists and specialists, but we don't have supervision built into our work. And yet, think about how many emotional issues and mental health issues we see every 10 minutes, right? Yeah. Why have we not embedded that as a profession? And that, I think, is a really important thing to sort of start talking about, perhaps as a college, is to start embedding that, because that's the space to talk. That's the place to expose some vulnerability. That's the place to get support. And coaching is, I think, a really good element of that. You know, certainly with sort of my coaching work, the conversations are transformative, because suddenly you give someone space that they haven't had. The things that they're thinking about suddenly become vocalized, and they're in the space and they can do something with that. And again, I think, just like everyone has a doctor, I think everybody should have a coach. You know, it's just so fundamental. This is the stuff I think that the college should start to champion as well. You know, we've done a bit of work on 15-minute consultations, and we're trying to do well-being, but actually, where's our space as a profession?
Hmm. I would agree with you, Alka. I've been mentored, and I found the experience just fantastic, just in terms of, you know, just refining some of those maybe things that you felt that you wanted to improve on, like maybe leadership or, you know, management skills, which, you know, nobody really teaches you anything about management really during your GP training. So I think that's really, you know, absolutely crucial just going forward. And as well as that, the clinical psychology and balance groups, I just do not understand why we do not have balance groups.
Why is it in psychiatry, they automatically have it, you know, every week or every fortnight, and we don't, you know, we deal with a whole range of mental health problems as well as the rest of medicine.
So I think from my point of view, there's two groups of patients that I seem to think have been affected most, and that's the group that have common mental health problems like anxiety, and it seems to have been ramped up during this time, understandably. But one of the problems is that a lot of the IAPT services, the psychology services, haven't been able to make the transfer over to sort of video consultations and telephone consultations. So they've stopped offering a service. So you've got this group of people that are getting worse, and there's nowhere really to direct them. There's lots and lots of things out there if you look, but it goes back to how... You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And who is the person that kind of gets them to the point where they can use those services? And I can try, I offer things, and I talk things through, but there still needs to be somebody or, you know, something that holds things together. The other group are people that have got serious and enduring mental illness, and that's a group that I really worry about a lot of the time, because community mental health teams haven't been able to offer them the same level of service. Wards are closed at the moment. You know, they're not having admissions of people that have been unwell. And so you've got people that have perhaps they've lived with, say, schizophrenia for a number of years, but then kind of their support has been taken away. So smaller things tend to become bigger things, which then tend to mean that there's nowhere. We've really struggled to get people being seen in crisis, and especially young people as well. I've got two young people that I see that CAMHS won't see them and adults won't see them. You know, and it's all, oh no, we can't see them because at the moment we're not taking new referrals and things. So there's that real, you know, risk. There is a lot of risk out there. And I think that what we're seeing now is that upward curve of mental illness. And I suspect, like, you know, the tsunami, I suspect it's going to keep peaking until, you know, it's going to keep rising until there is a peak. And we're not at that peak yet, I don't think.
Do you think there's going to be a lot of other mental health issues, including maybe obsessive trips maybe coming out in people as well from all this? Because I know one of my friends won't come out of her house.
Yeah.
Because she's not a medic, but she is so worried and anxious about being exposed. And I've been trying to ease her out, telling her, okay, you need to go out. You need to go for a walk. It's really important for your mental health to go out for a walk. And she's like, she'll go out, you know, under the cover of darkness or whenever there's really no people around. And you just think, that person's really going to struggle getting back to work. There's going to be real issues of people who haven't been out in the workforce, haven't been exposed to people, getting back out there. They'll really struggle from it.
All sorts of people who've been managing and who've been leading reasonable lives, you know, going to work, getting on with things. Say, for example, people who've had eating disorders and who've recovered. People seem to really struggle with lockdown and eating disorders. You know, they're stuck in the house, maybe on their own. And there's this thing about nobody to distract them, nothing to kind of, their support networks aren't there. So I think we will see a lot of stuff. And I really hope, but in a way, I hope people do come through with it, because I'd rather people come and see us and that we can start to support people than people presenting to A&E and just kind of bouncing around the system a bit. I think, you know, if we're prepared, and I mean, the one great thing is there are so many support things out there at the moment. There's suddenly been all this flourish of activity in terms of support, but it's getting the person in the right frame of mind to get that support, I think. And it's difficult. If you live on your own, you're depressed and, you know, no motivation, scared, anxious, don't want to go out the house. It's bad enough trying to see me and have a video consultation. You know, you've managed to tell me all what things that are going on, but then I'm telling you that you've got to kind of contact a psychology service, an IAPT service, and you've got to ring them, and you've got to, you know, it's that bit that's the difficult bit.
There's two things I wanted to pick up on there. Emma, you mentioned about, you know, going back to work. We're going to have a massive deluge of people whose mental health really suffer because they've lost their employment. So many people are being furloughed and then being made redundant. Yeah. You know, I had a man who came out of prison and he hasn't, very little chance, and of course now is not the time to be looking for a job, and then there will be a massive competitive market to compete against. And then the second thing is, you mentioned about people at home who are struggling and forming new habits. I think that's what we're going to be fighting against, because people will have formed new routines, and as Alka mentioned, we're particularly focused on well-being, but not as many people will be focused on making new healthy routines and daily habits of exercise and eating well, and we'll come out of this a lot worse, and it will be a lot harder to unravel and unpick those bad habits.
I think for me, there's probably one thing we haven't spoken about, in which I talk a lot about in the lifestyle sphere, but it's actually sleep. And there's such a correlation between sleep and mental illness. And I think some of the stats say that sleep problems precede depression in about 69% of patients and anxiety in about 30%. The difficulty as GPs is it's the one conversation we don't want to have because, and so we don't ask. But I think if every GP asked their patient, how are you sleeping? And we addressed sleep, because sleep is our, you know, it's our regulator, right? It's our emotional regulator. It addresses our IQ. It helps us with our empathy. It's got such a critical function in mental health and emotional regulation. But we need to tap into it before then sleep becomes the thing that you suffer with because of your depression. Because actually the telltale signs are there really, really early. And those are the sorts of conversations, if we're going to try and stop that tsunami that we keep referring to, we have to be the ones that know the science and the physiology of sleep to be able to bring it into a conversation and arm people with the sort of behavioral activation tools, the self-care tools that we know will work. But guess what? They need the patient to do something, and you have to have the motivator to do that. And I come back to health coaches, because you're saying, you know, you need someone to hold it together. This is who we should be having in our practices. Those behavioral motivators, those health coaches, get them, take people from the advice we give them in our consulting rooms to actually translating that into change and sustained change.
There is a lot of resources obviously out there now in terms of managing sleep, Alka, as well, which is, it's really interesting you brought it up, because I've been looking at my own personal phone to see, well, what's my sleep pattern been like? And it's been very up and down, and you really notice it in your day. And so if you think that there's a lot of people out there who are feeling anxious the whole day, they're not being able to, their work patterns disrupted, having to work late because they can't work during the day because the kids are at home, then there is a lot of people who are going to be very fatigued because of you know, not being able to sleep properly. And it's being able to give people those suitable resources and manage that amongst everything else. And we're very complicated as human beings, because it's never just, you know, we can't say to people, okay, to manage your mental health, you go out and exercise, you know, you sleep better, you know, you interact with people and everything will be great. And it doesn't work for everybody.
And you mentioned that, Alka, it's about how do we sustain it? And you mentioned health coaches. Perhaps there's a role for these social prescribers to be able to sort of give these lessons, perhaps in group sessions, where we can maintain this for a longer period than just within a 10-minute consultation, giving these sort of exercises to do. Because that's the difficulty, where you say they need that friend to say, okay, you need to self-analyze this, you need to take responsibility. Because even today, as you mentioned, I had three people that were having sleep problems.
But I think that the trick is that we have to think about the long haul and not the short fix. Mm-hmm. Better off having regular weekly consultations with the patient for 3 months rather than that constant revolving door for the next 30 years. And we've got to change our angle of view as GPs, I think. And also maybe arm ourselves with a few more tools. And I think we can, you know, we've got space to learn more. There's no point saying, oh, you know, CBT weights, that's the only thing that works for insomnia, but it's 6 months. It's like, do you know what? I've got a fantastic tool that I'm going to give to you right now. And we're going to embed that together, because as GPs, we can do that. I talk about our time being our own. And it is, you know, we invest in that patient to take them through one element of CBTI, because we've gone away and learnt about it and understand it. And then having those social prescribers, and I also think every social prescriber should be trained in motivational interviewing or health coaching, or every social prescriber is a health coach. They're your behaviour change specialists, aren't they? They're going to change what you say and translate it into what happens to the patient. Yeah.
And I think some GPs would say, oh, I haven't got time to do motivational interviewing in a consultation, or I haven't got the, you know, the I can't learn things like that. I've got so much else to do. But actually, if you think about it, by investing some time in that now, you're actually making your life as a GP so much easier because, you know, you've got that person in front of you and you're thinking, what do I do? You know, what do I do to them to make them better? But actually, you've got to take that step back. And that's, if you're continually taking responsibility for patients and their well-being, that's when you become burnt out and stressed. You've got to hand some of that responsibility back and support them.
What you've both described is that culture change. We need to stop seeing it as just the 10-minute consultation or these are the patients I'm seeing today, because we are known for community care and continuity of care.
But that's where other professionals come in as well. For example, the social worker. I know one of the things that have happened, one of the practices that I've been working in, all the elderly were contacted by a social worker in order that the social worker could figure out what their needs are so that they could be met, to help direct them to resources, to help manage their loneliness, to help manage any physical problems, to help manage, you know, food issues. That service has meant the constant kind of interaction with the social worker with these members of the population meant that they weren't then contacting us because they were feeling lonely, because maybe they weren't getting to sleep or they were worried because of what was going on in the outside world. I thought it was fantastic. I really thought it was absolutely fantastic. That alongside, you know, a program called Acute Care Team at Home, where, you know, this magical team goes out and manages all, you know, these elderly people with medical issues and ensures that, you know, they're kept at home, they're kept safe, you know, all their needs are addressed in their own home. You know, there is definitely, you know, a need for other healthcare professionals to do some of that work. And it's not just solely the responsibility of the GP to be everything. And that's, I think sometimes that's a problem we have as GPs. We want to fix everything. And we can't do all of that. There's other people who are maybe better trained than I am at doing that as well. I'm going to have three take-home tips today. Because there's been three things really from my point of view as a locum that has really helped me in my kind of day-to-day work. One, knock on people's door, ask them, do they want a cup of tea?
Yeah.
Ask them how they are. Because what you might actually find is maybe the person who is living alone at home as a doctor is, you know, really struggling with loneliness. Maybe the parent at home with the three kids who are driving her crazy just wants to have a normal conversation. And maybe you've got another, maybe a partner who's struggling with the intensity of the work, and maybe an elderly parent is really unwell. So just knock on someone's door, ask them, are they okay? Ask them, do you want a cup of tea or a break? Secondly, do get out and move. Whatever that is for you, whether it's dancing on your own in your house, whether it's running, whether it's, I can't say swimming because we're not allowed to swim just yet. And then thirdly, I have quite a supportive CPD group, a bunch of girls which are fantastic. And we try and link in, you know, every few weeks just to check in how each other is. So it's really important to have a group around you that are maybe experiencing the same kind of things, just to keep things real, to ask you, well, how are you at the minute? Is everything okay? And, you know, it's really just important overall just to look after yourself and whatever you need, because everyone is very different in terms of what they need. And we just can't typecast someone. So whatever it is you need to do, do it for yourself.
For me, I would say try and modelling behaviour. So the behaviour that you want from others, you must demonstrate yourself. So as part of a team, healthy behaviours, and show that. And also, I think within your team, as a leader, as you know, a manager or whatever, show that it's okay to say that you're not okay. and to talk about it, you know, to share that. Because I think unless we do it without, you know, we've got experience and I'm old enough now, I've got kids and, you know, I just don't care anymore. But, you know, for those people that I manage or, you know, I work with, some of them are quite young, they're just starting out, then they don't have that same attitude in terms of being able to say, I'm struggling, being able to recognise that early. So I think it's some of it's our responsibility to encourage that.
I really like that, Liz. I'm a big proponent of making sure that people share and are honest about their feelings and that people reach out and seek help. I think if anything, throughout this coronavirus period, I've gone through a whole range of emotions. And I think just acknowledging that you're having those and accepting that they're neither good nor bad, you're just experiencing them. And then, you know, if you are having sort of negative thoughts, I sort of introduced this exercise because I realized on some days I was coming home to my partner and just going, oh, this was bad. Just really pausing again and setting myself the goal of coming home and remembering just one positive thing, similar to having a gratitude journal, just one positive thing and telling that story and flipping that narrative so that you can focus on what positive things we've learned from or we've experienced throughout this.
One really interesting thing that I did in my practice one day was called A Day in My Shoes. And what I did is it was just a piece of paper and I mapped out every 5 minutes what I was doing, what that interruption was, what that issue was in the consultation, did I get up, did I have a break, did I eat, what was I actually doing for every 5 minutes? And it was such an eye-opener because then I shared it with people and then everybody else wanted to do that. And what we managed to do was actually realize what the blockers in our day were, realize the times that we did or didn't spend together, recognize where we could make efficiencies, recognize where, you know, where somebody literally had sat at their desk all day long. And it was such a good exercise. If there is probably one thing that as a practice people can do this exercise, A Day in My Shoes, map out your day, and then do what we've been saying, spend some time, take time to just reflect on it, share it, and have a practice conversation. Have conversations with the person in the next room or your team about what that means and what you can do differently to then start embedding that kind of feel good in your day. You know, there's one day like no one made me a cup of tea and it was the smallest thing, but I recognized that in, you know, A Day in My Shoes and was able to change that. Or I was able to make a cup of tea for somebody else, you know, and it is those small things that make a difference in our day, but there are also big issues that will come up. So I'd be really interested to know if people do that and what people come up with in terms of their well-being.
Huge thanks to our guests this week. Check out the notes on our Audio Boom page to follow their work, as well as access mental health and wellbeing resources. If you have been affected by anything raised here or need urgent support, you can text NHS PH to 85258. Thanks for listening and see you next time.